Okay, let's go.
Welcome everyone to the first Existence podcast of this year. Today we will take you all over the world with Norwegian professor Ole Maustad and try to give you a look into his backpack full of knowledge and experience. Ole has developed his own method on approaching urbanism, which is called Urban Triggers. He has starred in movies, he sounds like he knows Western Europe as if it was his backyard, and he has developed his own vision on the architectural debate. We will discuss inclusivity, cultural exchange, and try to get his opinion on the widely discussed urban sprawl in Belgium. Because we already know you know something about it, but could you briefly explain to the people who listen to the podcast why you know Belgium?
Yes, that's because half my family is there. My wife, Hette Pisters, has grown up in Wemmel, just off the ring in Brussels. And with our children, we have spent like every holiday in Belgium. And she's introduced me to basically everything I know about Belgium. She's an architect and she's well-educated in Brussels at the art school there and studied architecture in Denmark and from there.
And how long have you been practicing architecture, or how did you get to know it?
Well, my first sort of conscious experience of architecture was in theater. Working as an actor, you are working in a space and with a space and giving actually meaning to the space through what you do. And that's how I sort of my interest turned from acting to the space that I was acting in. So with a small shift of perspective, I started studying architecture instead. And from there, the years of studies and practice. And
did you have been practicing theater and acting a long time before you started?
For a few years, 6, 7, 8 years, yes.
Okay, so you were like 25 years old when you started to...
Yeah.
Okay, to do architecture. And has your vision changed a lot since you began with the first remarks of architecture and the first thoughts?
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, my interest was always the dynamics of architecture. The experience in theater is that space is never a constant. It's never static because one, in the same space you have King Lear, and then you have Waiting for Godot the next day. In the same space. So that's the magic of the space of theater. And inspired, you could say, by Shakespeare, we're all actors and the world is a stage and blah, blah, blah. There you go. That's an interesting framing of architecture. So what if the same thing is true outside the theater as inside?
So I guess you could say as an architect, your goal is to change the theater for the everyday life of people, influence it?
No, but it is well, yes and no. But the entrance becomes that just like in theater, you think, you try to give meaning to existence. You try to get to understand why Godot, where did he go? Why are we waiting for him? You know, it's a production of meaning that it's sort of an active cognitive process. And when you take that with you outside, of course, you need to understand architecture not as static objects, but as an environment in which needs to think with you collectively. So in that sense, it's not more of it's changing people's lives the same way as a poet would do, or you would do as an actor or as an architect. It's not that you go out and you change people's lives, but you take an active part in the ongoing process of sort of becoming human.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. I think as a last general introduction question, the architectural field knows a lot of different subjects. What is the specific field that you're interested in right now or working on or with?
I think the answer to that is would be in my book, Cognition and the Built Environment.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take sort of the phrase of giving meaning to people's lives, it's a cognitive work if you take it into a scientific thing. And that is a sort of a trope which is well known to architects. I mean, architects have been thinking in that way basically forever. Kevin Lynch quite masterly formulated this in The Image of the City, like in 1960. Science is a bit slower at getting to the point, but eventually it does. And contemporary cognitive science is actually there that it answers to Kevin Lynch, and it says that that thinking is not an intracranial divine thing immaterially happening. It's actually an interaction between what you have inside your head and what you have outside it. And the implication of which is that our built environment is part of, you could almost say, our exobrain. Like the anthill is part of the ant's way of organizing and giving form to its life. The fantastic thing with architecture is that we very conscientiously shape it. So if you could imagine, you're actually part of your own brain, no? It's yeah. Quite exciting.
That's definitely true. That's good to hear. And we came, of course, to study in Norway to broaden our horizon. But how about you? Did you broaden your horizon in other parts of the world?
Yes, certainly. Certainly, I think after my PhD, which I did in the beginning of the 90s, I sort of worked out some basics of cognition and architecture. I was lucky enough to get a position at the American University of Beirut, which just then came out of an almost 20-year civil war. So I had a fantastic opportunity to do the research of an exobrain. And it's when it doesn't work, you know, when a system breaks down, you get to see what it's consisting of. When the sewers don't work, you get very conscious of the meaning of sewers in the city. And when garbage just piles up in the street and the postal system doesn't work, and the electricity is depending on generators on people's balconies, it becomes very, very obvious what makes a city tick. And when it's a civil war, you have sort of the social system also collapsing in on itself. And that makes a lot of things very visible and very clear to you. So it was like being able to make brain surgery on a corpse and study things in a way that you hardly get the chance to in any other under other conditions. The pathology of cognitive pathology of a city. That was probably the most important. So the experience of the years in the Middle East and the post-war situation was a very formative one. So that's sort of been giving insights that I've had the chance to look at also in Eritrea, in Africa, and under other conditions. The years in China, there was not war. It's very peace and quiet in a certain sense, but the urbanization had a tempo which was almost catastrophic. So it was also giving important insights in urban development.
Okay, that sounds very drastic happening in your lifetime. But have you also visited like Central Europe or Western Europe to experience things that are happening in there?
Yes, of course. Of course, for family reasons, I know, for instance, Belgium very well. And maybe I should have mentioned Belgium first, because the sort of the experience of Belgian urbanism has been very important too. In Norwegian literature, there's an author, Alexander Kielland, who was writing, has a story of a small boy at school and describing how the small boy was suffering under a very authoritarian teacher. And one of the examples from there was when he was having his geography lessons. And the sort of the quote of that chapter is, more cities in Belgium. He had to name all the cities of Belgium, which was sort of an almost impossible task, which I have come to over the years to understand that, yes, indeed, it is a very, very urbanized area. And the Belgian sort of diamond is probably the, together with Randstad, it has been generally held to be the most urbanized and densest populated areas in the world, I think. Probably it's contested by China and India and whatnot now, but it is very intensively urbanized. And there's been a lot of very interesting experiences for a young architect to sort of get to know and to study.
Okay, so that sounds very interesting. And I know we have already been discussing a bit about it, but you have a very different way of looking at the urban sprawl and the lintbebouwing, zoals we had kennen in België. But do you also have like more positive way of thinking of it, because it's been discussed in Belgium as a very negative like fabric and way of living? The public transport is not running as it should be, the infrastructure is lacking, there is too much cars, there are a lot of discussions going on about it, and I wanted to know how you think about that.
Of course public transport is a problem anywhere. And too much cars. What do you want? It's the most densest populated areas in the world. I mean, it's running on roads that are very old. It's a wonder that it's magic that it's running at all, but it is. And what sort of struck me as strange is, you know, you learn about urban planning, you learn about how the Dutch do it, how the French do it, how the British, the German, and through the 20th century, there's been a continuous deficiency of housing in all these countries. And, you know, of course, you think that, okay, yeah, First World War, Second World War, what have you, I mean, with all the bombing and destruction and so on. And then you sort of realize that the densest, the highest population density in the Flanders there's never been a housing deficiency. How come? How could that be? It's more people than anywhere else per square kilometer. It's not that the wars have been fought anywhere else. I mean, it's been the battlefield in basically every war in Europe. And at that point, there is not a deficiency of housing. How come? There must be something somewhere in that system where either planning is very smart or the absence of planning allows for other kinds of smartness. I don't know. But it sort of became a mystery that caught my interest.
Yeah, it's like Bo said, it's very controversial. And I think now the government or the people in Belgium are starting to battle it, because it's, well, we can't ignore the facts that there's too much traffic and pollution and noise and all the bad things that come with the urban sprawl. So I think there's a plan. It's called the Betonstop. I think it's by 2040. So do you see it as a new beginning, or is it the end of something that worked really well?
Just to explain, the Betonstop is not a plan to not use concrete anymore. It's more like a plan to stop building on new plots and start using land that's not being used already.
Hmm. Yeah, and to densify, because I think the previous Bouwmeester, Leo van Broek, I think his whole argument was that we should stop snipping up and dividing nature and take back the cities and make them denser and more people and give back nature what we took from it years ago.
Mm-hmm. Inspired by cities like Paris and maybe even China with much higher densities, he sees a lot of more potential in those kind of examples.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't be qualified to go in and take up that discussion, but I think that there is an intrinsic intelligence and adaptability in the way of, for instance, the Lintbebauing. It has got qualities that are quite unique. And when you hear now from, like in the Netherlands, for instance, where they're also struggling with comparable problems, except that they're still struggling with a housing shortage. One of their new concepts is plot-based urban development. I mean, it sounds like an echo of the Lintbebauing to me. And you say, okay, the Lintbebauing is plot by plot, shoulder by shoulder, from one urban core to the next. And the way that the Lintbebauing is put together, every plot has got an ecosystem. It has got a piece of agriculture in the back, a few rabbits, a goat, what do I know, some flowers, and it has got a house, which very often is a little bit bigger than just mom and dad and two kids would need, or like with four kids. It is slightly oversized, so it can also comprise like a small shop or an office or something on the ground floor. It can comprise some student housing on top. It can comprise an extra generation. But it is small enough to be like one piece of ownership in one family, which is a very sympathetic thing, and which gives a size that you would not find in modern developments, except for in the absolute top end housing of 150, 200 square meters for a housing unit. Then it has a public side to a street. And in the cases where you have the geslote bebauing, as you call it, where houses are shoulder by shoulder, it's a public street, and there is a density enough to run a bus. It's a density enough to keep a cafe alive every so many hundred meters, and a shop. And so in a certain sense, you have an ecosystem within the housing unit or the property of the of that unit, which is almost complete. And when you look at that as an algorithm, you can follow it. If you look at the aerial photos of Belgium, you can follow it into the city. And when you as you approach the urban core, you go up from 2.5 to 3.5, maybe 4.5 floors. The building width stays within like usually 6 meters, something like that. Just enough to have your own stairwell, which allows every floor to the flexibility of use of the different floors for a grand family to grow and shrink. And it still has the green backside and the public front side. So when we discuss urban agriculture, it's already built into the Lintbebauing, and you compress it and you can follow it into Schaerbeek, into to Antwerp and Ghent, and you see it from the air, and almost not every but very many of those housing typically have the possibility for a small garden and a rabbit. It's very fascinating, but it's very possible that it belonged to the 20th century, and that the pressures of the 21st are outgrowing that model. I don't know, but I was terrified when I saw last year in Antwerp that developers now buy like 3, 4, 5 plots next to each other and make apartment buildings instead, and it's a total ruin of the urban grain and fabric that has got this diversity. Urban diversity as well as biodiversity built into it, the ecosystem of the housing unit. So before you allow that richness and complexity of the urban fabric to go lost, I hope at least that you analyze it and you understand sort of the qualities and the sophistication of that way of building. So you might be able to preserve and renew and sort of bring some of those, that sophistication with you into the next sort of green wave. Otherwise, I'm so afraid that you'll just throw the baby out with the washing water.
So it sounds a bit like the small brother of the Parisian housing unit, where they have the flexibility on the different floors as well, but they have a more dense fabric, and they don't have the green backyard. So that's maybe also a good comparison. And do you think that the Belgian system of urban sprawl, as it is developed like unguided and completely naturally, that it's a good working system and an algorithm that's been working for over the years, and that it still has a future?
I would hope so. Because it has basically performed quite well, I think, for quite a few centuries. And the problem is, yes, it's sprawl. You talk to Belgian architects and students like you guys, and you hear only bad things about the Belgian sprawl and the stupid Lintbebauing. I think, no. don't miss the point of that sophistication of complexity of a housing unit. And it implies one thing is what you have built into it, but it also implies an ownership. It applies social structures and economy, which is solidly embedded sort of in the owner of in the family of the house. It's an old fashioned, it's probably medieval socioeconomic structure. It's a very, it's a clan structure almost of the family is so strong in Belgium that it's stronger than in I think most other European countries. And you have oddities of Witte Pot and Zwarte Pot and things going under the table and over the table, and these things are of course also part of that complexity of the Lintbebauing and the ownership of the housing market, so to speak. Maybe it's tentacles from the Middle Ages that are sort of have gone their course. I don't know, but I hope you're able to sort of preserve some of the good ideas of it. Yeah,
exactly. I think it makes me think of the, we have a saying in Belgium that een oude boom verpot men niet zomaar, of verplant men niet zomaar. I think it's one of those huge benefits of having your own house throughout centuries or generations, maybe. Yeah. Because if I think of my own grandparents, there's no way I could take them out and put them in an apartment where they get service and all the good stuff. They would rather die in their own home. And it's something that's really difficult to achieve in a building tower or something. So I guess there's more to it than just the, oh, we're taking up space and then nature, and which is important too, but...
Definitely.
It's probably also part of conserving the culture that we have, and don't just start building new apartment blocks because they will wash away what we have or had over the past few decades or centuries.
Yeah. So I think talking about this city stuff... it leads me to our next question is, you're teaching a course, urban development, and as we've experienced, you have a very specific method of teaching. It's with the resources, the value chains, the triggers. Could you briefly describe what it is and what you try to achieve with it?
Yes, we're trying to understand. First of all, I think that an important framing of it is to understand our built environment as a cultural process, as a cognitive process. And in that frame, urban planning sort of starts to become part of the problem and not of the solution, because you need to be able to keep thinking and to keep developing a society. You have to be agile, and your units must be like the Lintbebauing units. You must sort of be able to absorb changes and to adapt to them and so on, to react intelligently, and for the city to react intelligently. Therefore, it's necessary to understand urban development not as the modernist project of starting with a blank sheet, blank slate, and construct it from zero, the whole city. That's not what cities do. Cities change. They don't pop up as cities. They change. And when we change them, we need to change them project by project, plot by plot, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that has repercussions for this, for the process of creating changes and of managing them, which is something else than starting with a blank sheet and designing the future. So within that frame, we're looking for trigger points. We look at the city as a living system, and we try to identify trigger points and resources and agents who act on it, and to sort of define every project. So the research that you have been doing, for instance, now on a big part of Oslo is first mapping of resources, human resources, natural resources, financial resources, and so on. From there, try to understand the value chains that make things move and things happen. And from there, find the spaces where it can be done better, and to redesign value chains to trigger new urban development. So that's more or less the philosophy of it.
Yeah. So it's like designing, it's like making a really small change in the urban fabric and then let it do its thing, because that's what happens in cities. You don't plan for the future. I mean, some architects like to plan for the future, but it's really difficult because you don't expect, you can't predict the future. So you just have to do something and then hope for the best. Is that part of the process?
Yeah, you could say so, but we're trying to take it a little bit beyond hope, to make it's trying to create to initiate the best development. And I think a reference would be like Christopher Alexander, already in the 1980s, in his book about the new urban design or something, new theory of urban design or something. He said that we have to realize that we don't build cities anymore. We change them. And that is sort of the key point.
And then as another take on this, architects used to be the big planners on each scale of the city, but nowadays we see that a lot of big projects are being funded and planned by project developers with profit in their minds as a main goal. But we as architects don't have the tools to think in this economical way anymore. But should we be capable to do this again in the future? And is there some way we can try to do that? Is it with information and data and more numbers than just thinking of beautiful buildings?
Well, that's a key point that you give there, that the role of the architect is not anymore what it used to be. And that's a very sad and absolute truth, like one, two generations ago, we were unquestionably sort of the coordinator and the person who brought things together. And now we're just sort of, basically, we're a decorator. And all project decisions are made by the big developers, by the politicians, by engineers, by lawyers, and when a project is defined and established as a project on a site, the architect is invited to come in and make it look good. I mean, basically that's what's happening, and that part is being automated rapidly. So what architecture as a discipline has missed was the train that came 30, 40 years ago, when all the consultants and financiers and the developers were growing and outgrowing our discipline. Then architects, a lot of architects insisted on sort of their traditional classic role, and we grew irrelevant simply because we didn't develop our knowledge to understand the forces that actually shape the city. And we can struggle against the developers and finance and what have you, but there's never in the history of architecture been one piece of architecture without a client. I mean, architects don't build their own house as a profession. There is no architect if he doesn't have a client. He cannot save buildings in his storeroom and sell them in the shop. So he needs a client. And then the client is necessary to understand who is that, what forces are driving this process. And when those forces, during the latest 30, 40, 50 years, shot speed with the new technologies and information technologies and finance and liberalization and deregulation of finances and all of this, we sort of missed the train a bit. And now it's a kind of an urgent matter to develop our knowledge base so that we can go in and work on those processes that result in projects. Those processes need our knowledge, but we have to be able to deliver relevant knowledge. And that's also what we're trying to develop in Urban Triggers. Otherwise, we'll just be decorators.
Yeah, I think I'd just like to add to that. For architecture to exist, you need clients. I think earlier you mentioned that architecture can exist without architects, because if there's a client, they just find a way, and it doesn't need to be architecturally relevant. It can just happen without architects. Is that kind of true?
Yeah, I'm not saying the results necessarily are good, but definitely if you look out of the window or anywhere, I mean, most of what you see is built without the use of proper architects. If you have an engineer and you can pay for it and you can sort of meet the requirements in the legislation, you're fine. So it's not a sine qua non of having a qualified architect. But the client is a sine qua non.
And do you think that, or a better question is, what are like the tools that we could use or need to find for as an architect to get more grasp on the built environment and to play a bigger role again? Do you have any idea of the tools?
Well, that's knowledge about understanding of economy, for instance, of ecology. It's understanding of the dynamics of the city. What makes it tick? Why is it there? How does it work? You have to understand those things, and we are sort of the, what do we say, the doctors who make it tick, and to help it fix it when it doesn't work, and to repair the spots that are deficient, and improve, and you know. And then you have, it's knowledge. But we have to sort of go beyond the traditional modern professional role that we considered to be the architect, because that was sort of the artists of the building, of the built environment. But there's a lot of more knowledge that needs to go in now, technical, technological, financial dynamics, the finances of a city, ownership, all these things, they pressure on project all the way. interaction between public money and private money, political wills, cultural values. All of these things are very, very strong forces, and they work on a project. And before sort of the commission lands in the architectural office to design a new housing project, somebody has been doing all that work. Somebody has been making those decisions about how to spend money, when to do this, how to fit it into these and these processes, how to deal with the political and social landscape around it. All of that is being done. It's just not being done by architects anymore.
So could we see it as the architect that has a role to connect other players or other partners in the deal and like set them up to make deals with each other?
Yes.
And less as the artist that it used to be.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, in that sense, you could go back to Aristotle. In his metaphysics, he's writing about the architect, and he says that the architect is the head of all the artists. And now he's not talking fine arts; he's talking of arts and crafts. I mean, people who know things. Huh? The architect is on top of the pyramid because he has the theoretical, he has the skills of how to do things, build houses, but he also has the knowledge of why and how to, why to do it and how to do it. With the arche, he's got the ideas and the skills. That was the antique architect. And then for many years, he sort of went into the arche part of it, went into oblivion, and it was tectonics. And now we need to sort of resurrect the antique architect.
Sort of a homo universalis, someone that can...
In a certain...
That knows a bit about everything.
Yes, knows enough about everything to sort of bring it together and work in it. And that also means that the architects should stop thinking about him or herself as one genius, because it's got to be a team. Mm. You need so much knowledge into that system that you can't keep it in one head. It is a teamwork where many skills and many kinds of knowledge must be present. But you must have the skill of running that teamwork.
Okay. Yeah, it's very well put. I mean, it's food for thought, I think. One of our final questions, because I think you have a plane to catch. In Unité, it's the magazine that we're bringing out with our student organization back at home. For this edition, we have chosen a specific theme, and it's inclusivity. It's just a very broad word. Do you have any definition or a thought that comes into mind when you hear the word inclusivity?
Well, the last thing I said now was in the teamwork of the architect as a knowledge. Kind of knowledge needs to be inclusive. It has to be inclusive, otherwise it won't work.
And on the I think we're mostly focusing on the social aspect, like different layers in the social structure, different kind of incomes, different backgrounds. Is it something that can be practiced on the scale of a city?
Because yeah,
we're talking urban everything. Is there something like urban inclusivity, or is it more you need this ramp for people in wheelchairs to be able to access it?
Generalized accessibility, yes. But I think maybe like we have been discussing in class today, we've been talking about complexity and diversity in the sort of the media discourse. I mean, cultural... diversity is a big subject. In the green this climate thing, we're talking about biodiversity. And biodiversity is sort of generally accepted, that understood now, that that nature needs diversity to survive. It depends on diversity. So it needs to include ants and mosquitoes and butterflies. And we have to sort of, we cannot opt out the wasps or the bees because they sting. Mm. Without bees, there's no flowers. So that diversity needs to be there in nature. And in the city is part of nature. The city is a part of nature. It's the human part of nature. So it needs the diversity, which means that to keep the city alive, you have to include, to be inclusive.
For everybody.
For everybody.
I think the bees and the ants are just metaphors for all kinds of people and all kinds of backgrounds. And
yeah
that's nice. It's I've never heard somebody put it this way, like comparing it to nature. That's, I think the last question is maybe a quick one, just to finish it. You have, I think, we're in your office right now. You have a lot of books, and I suppose you read a lot of books. For us beginner architects, is there one must-read book that you could recommend?
Ah, that's a difficult one. To put my finger on one, no, I mean, there's so much good books to read, but I think lately, sort of, there are some of the classics from the 1960s that sort of resurrect and turn out to be, in my view, more valuable than I understood as a student, and that is Jane Jacobs and Kevin Lynch. I'll stop there.
Okay.
There's many more.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
But those are like
top of the
old démodé classics coming back with a vengeance and really with a new shine to them, I think.
Okay, and maybe one last question. Is there any advice that you could give to the younger Ule or to the students that are starting nowadays at what they need to look out for, or what's the most important thing to do?
Don't get stuck with architectural objects. The house that you design is a means for much larger urban and cultural ends. It is not a goal. It's a tool. And remember that one house has no meaning without the context. What do you want with a house if you can't go to work, if you can't go to school, if you can't go to buy bread and butter? The house is just a part of a life world. So you have to understand it as that and not get blended by the shiny objects.
Okay, I guess we can call it a day now, and we can start to thank you, Ule, and also thank you to all the people who have listened. And don't forget to enjoy every second of your life, because time flies.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ik hoop dat jullie genoten hebben van deze podcast en we willen jullie ook bedanken om te luisteren. Graag danken we ook nog onze sponsor Archipelago. Zonder hen was deze podcast namelijk niet mogelijk geweest.